なとこに家がある。
やっぱり間違いないな。テーマパークの残骸だよこれ。90年頃にあっちこっちでたくさん計画されてさ、バブルが弾けてみんな潰れちゃったんだ。これもその一つだよきっと。
まだ行くの？お父さんもう帰ろうよ。ねえ、
Welcome to Backstory Podcast, presented by the Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. I'm Aaron Collier. This is part two of Big Sky Wild Mushrooms, our conversation with animators Ann Koizumi and Howie Shaw. If you're starting here, you should go back and listen to part one, just so you don't get too lost. Because what you're about to listen to right off the bat is Ann's commentary on her work in The Shadow of the Pine, which, if you haven't watched it already, please pause the episode now and go watch her film, which can be found on YouTube or CBC Gem. We've linked the work in our show notes so you know where to find it. And now, if you're coming back, part two of our conversation with Ann Koizumi and Howie Shaw.
Good to go?
I think so.
Okay, let's go. 3, 2, 1.
Okay, so the film begins with me searching for Mutsteke, and Mutsteke is also known as pine mushroom. You can find it in the interior of BC. So just to give you a bit of context, Mutsteke is a delicacy in Japan, and the reason it is because you can't cultivate it. They only grow in very particular environments where the conditions have to be just right for them to grow. And you'll see this scene again at the end of the film, and I'll speak more about the symbolism then. So the classroom scene where my dad comes to my class to clean up the mess of another student was the first scene I animated. It's probably one of my strongest childhood memories, definitely not my favorite. I didn't have a storyboard or a script when I started shooting. I just knew that the scene had to be in the film. And so I started making the sets, the puppets, and then I shot it with a friend who's also an animator, Jerome Bretichet. In the background of the scene, you'll actually see the Rocky Mountains. So I grew up in Calgary, Alberta, where the Rockies are maybe an hour and a half away. And I've always loved this landscape, and I had to include them in my film. So 88 was actually the original title of the film. And my mom still lives in the house where I grew up, which is 88, and I won't give the address, but with my sister and her family. And there were a couple of other 88 references, like the 1988 Winter Olympics that were hosted in Calgary, but I decided to go in another direction. So I actually went back to my elementary school when I started my research, and the principal let me in during the winter break and let me walk around and take photos. So the colors you see in the scene are the same colors of the walls when I was going there. And the kids' voices here, they're actually my sound designer's kids. So my sound designer was Renee Ruiz. So I start going into the family photos. I love old family photos. I found this one of my dad and I eating dim sum. As a family, we never ate out at restaurants unless it was Chinese food. And even that was really rare. My dad really loved flavorful food, and Chinese food was definitely one of his favorites. So this scene, I talk about the kind of ideal dad that I wanted. I definitely wanted my father to be either Mr. Miyagi from The Karate Kid or one of the Japanese businessmen in Die Hard. So I created these cutouts using 80s and 90s vintage men's magazines that my sister found in Tokyo. And so I had a lot of fun with this collage sequence. I really didn't want the images to feel too precious. So you'll notice that I was kind of messy with the cutouts in some areas. I originally wanted to shoot this under the camera like an animation, but in the end, I just did everything in Photoshop. That is me dressed as a Maiko when I was living in Japan in 2003. Wave sequence is probably the hardest shot to shoot, the most difficult shot. It took me one 10-hour day to shoot 1 second of animation, and that scene is 14 seconds long. This is archival footage. It was actually shot at the orphanage where my father was raised. It was shot in 1949 in Kumamoto, which is on the southern island of Kyushu. So the backstory of the orphanage where my father was raised is that it was started by American Lutheran missionaries before the war started. My father was living there actually at the time this was shot. He was probably about 6 or 7 years old. I explain in the film that after my grandfather, my dad's dad, dies, my grandmother was alone with 5 children. And the orphanage offered her work in exchange for her for a place to stay and to raise her kids. So a film crew was sent by the United Lutheran Church of America to shoot a film about a Japanese orphan converted to Christianity and became a Lutheran pastor. That film is called Fujita, and my cousin, who I was visiting and doing when I was doing research in Kumamoto at the time, gave me a copy of the film, and he was also able to get me a tour of the orphanage, which is still there. This is the living room scene. So this is probably one of the hardest sets to build for me emotionally. Because it's a recreation of my family's old living room. My dad loved fake flowers. They were all secondhand. He decorated our house with them. He also went through a phase where he tiled everything black and white, kind of after it was trendy. The scene itself is a homage to my family, because each family member is actually represented by an image or an object. And sometimes when I was creating those objects, I would just start crying because I just felt so emotional. It's really the scene where my father gets to explain himself to me, but that entire voiceover is all scripted by me. I used the interviews I conducted with those who knew my father well, his brothers, his sister-in-law, his best friend, my mom, my siblings, write his voice. And I just wanted to show the audience that I interviewed people to construct my father's story, you know, a story that he didn't talk about when he was alive. You can see his ghost visit me in this scene, and making this film really felt like that, like he was talking to me, like he was inside or kind of a part of all of the objects that I created. So if you look at this next photo here, if you look closely, you'll see the 88 Olympics reference on my sister's blue sweatshirt. So I just kind of wanted to throw that in there as well. And we are back in the forest scene. I'm looking for Matsuke. And again, I never had a real script or storyboards. I was speaking to my brother on the phone one day, and he reminded me about all the Matsuke hunting that we did. And, you know, these were memories that I wanted to recreate without really thinking too hard about the symbolism, but it was all really, it just felt like really organic and natural. But of course, when I thought about this memory of us going Matsuke hunting, it made sense. So, and really this memory is about me, being on this journey, searching for my identity, searching for who I am. You know, that thing that's rare and elusive, and it's very difficult to find. It's really hard and difficult to find it. And it's ultimately my father who's leading me to it. So I feel like I was talking a mile a minute.
That's great.
It was great, though. There's so much information to cover. It's amazing.
There was a lot.
I made half a point where you
made... You said director's commentary, and I was just like, oh my God, I have to be talking through this whole thing.
Different directors are different.
And I know you mentioned how you didn't really have a storyboard set up for your short. I'm just curious, like, how did you end up arriving at the order in which you put these scenes together?
I didn't have a storyboard, and I didn't even really have a script. And I think the way that I was making the film, and mind you, it took me almost 4 years to make this film, I was basically shooting. Well, I'd decide I'm going to shoot a scene, and I would, you know, make the puppets and the sets, did a lot of it on my own, with the exception of the animation. I did that with my friend, and I would just shoot a scene and then I would edit it together on my computer, and then I would just leave it, and then I would shoot another scene and then edit it together. And then I just had kind of like all of these separate scenes. And then it wasn't until like the last year or that I started to assemble it. And my friend actually gave me an idea of creating a conversation between my father and I, because she watched the forest scene, which had been shot like really early on in production. And the only thing that was being said in the forest scene was me calling out for my dad in the forest. And then when she saw that, she said, you know, the structure of the film could really be based as like, could be a conversation between you and your dad. And that's kind of what gave me the script structure for it. Because initially it was like me kind of narrating and talking to the audience. Like when I would edit together a clip, I would do like my own voice recordings and just talk about what you were seeing essentially, and kind of describing it to the audience. But then as soon as my friend said that, and that was like maybe less than a year ago, I was like, that makes sense. And then I started to write a script for my dad. And and so really, like, that's when the archival footage started to, like, that's when I wrote the script for my dad, and then I edited the archival footage. And then even the last, the photo collage sequence was like the last thing I shot, which was like maybe in February or like December, January, February. And that all just kind of came together as I was editing.
I love to hear when things kind of just come together, like something just unlocks an idea and just powers, you know, you to completion, or just takes the project in another direction. It's so cool to hear that kind of thing. And then also, you know, whenever that happens to your own work, it's so cool. You know, something that both you, Anne, and Howie mentioned, and this is just totally changing my perception of what I thought I was gonna ask you about, and that, like, did I hear you both say that you didn't have storyboards? Because I always thought, like, oh, animators, they plan everything out, like everything's planned out. So that's not true.
Well, not for me. I'm just not, like, I'm a self-taught animator, and I only really make my own films, because I don't think I could, like, I just don't imagine myself being able to work professionally. Like, for me, I like that freedom of just not being, you know, stuck in a linear system where it's just like you have a script and you storyboard and animatic and then you start shooting. And I understand why in animation production you would do that, especially because it's very, you know, time consuming and it's expensive. But really, this project, I did it outside of my work hours. Like, I was working on it on my own. I did take like an 8-month sabbatical to work on it initially, to do the research and shoot a couple of scenes. But outside of that, I did everything, you know, outside of my day job, basically. So I needed that freedom to play around and to just experiment. Like, I had a bunch of scenes that I shot that never ended up in the film. I was experimenting with different techniques. I thought I was going to use a bunch of different techniques and I didn't. But I just need that kind of freedom to be able to do that, and to not have like somebody asking me, like, outside of my friends, when I'm going to finish the film. So yeah, I'm just like, I would say that I'm very non-traditional in that sense. But I don't, like, Howie must have a totally different work practice. I don't know. Howie, you can answer that question.
I mean, it's not that different. I've done a lot of stuff with the NFB. I've been lucky to do that. And they require, they're very interesting. The animation studio is a really interesting place, because they absolutely understand sort of, especially with the kind of animation that they champion, they understand that, or encourage it to be an organic process, which often animation is not. Certainly studio animation is not necessarily. They also require, in order to sort of move things along through development, they need to have a sense of what you're making. So there is like an initial animatic of sorts. But for me, that's and luckily for the people looking at it, they know that it's just a starting point. I think it's I imagine it's similar to like storyboards are all fine and good in live action, but you can't really do anything until you're on set. You don't really know what it's going to be until it's on set. You're on set. Aram, you could certainly speak to this. Tell me if I'm wrong. But
yeah, I don't do storyboards either. I do a shot list and I have it planned in my head, but it's like, it's going to change.
Yeah, it's just like, because I have a really hard time taking my storyboard drawings seriously enough to believe in it in any way. Like, they're really bad drawings. And I can't for the life of me commit myself to doing a good drawing for a storyboard for some reason. Or you know, just a drawing that I don't know that I've ever done a good drawing, but like a drawing that I'm really committed to. So it's not until like I know I'm making the film that I will sit down and like really put together an image that I think has some emotion and direction to it. And then I have that, and then the film sort of, and then that scene sort of plays out. But it's not until I'm actually working on the film that the actual composition and movement and all that stuff happens. When you have to hire other people to sort of help animation, then that's a bit harder, and you have to sort of, what I usually hand them is a fully finished first frame with as much of the layout as I can, so that it feels like I have my actors in place, I've set up the camera, and so I know what that, the feeling of that shot is supposed to be. I'd rather not be tied down too much until I actually start animating.
So, and it sounds like then you have this scene where you're looking for mushrooms in the forest. So this was something that you kind of created independently, that it was a memory that you had?
This is a recurring memory. This is like our summer vacations were camping and searching for Mutstucke. So, but it really is kind of one of my fondest memories of spending time with my dad. I really enjoy being out in nature. And I think that's definitely one of the things that I miss about, you know, being in Calgary, is that I was so close to the mountains. I was close to Drumheller, which has like the hoodoos and the desert. And then you're close to the prairies. So I really think it was my dad who like gave me the appreciation nature, you know, because that's what we would do. Like I always wanted to go to Disneyland as a kid. I never did, but he took us camping, and I'm really glad that he did now.
Yeah, I found it really, again, sorry, not to like re-bring up the storyboard piece again, but it's actually really neat that there wasn't like a planned out way that you wanted to tell the story, just because I feel this film in particular, like based off of your memories, the way that like memory works, it's not linear. And I think kind of going off from that, you did a lot of research into it, from like pulling this like footage of the orphanage to the family photos to the actual interview. So I'm just curious, like how long that did that take? And for sure it was like your story to tell, but also all the other people that were involved in this film as well, the people that you interviewed. What did that bring up for them as well? It just seemed like a very like collective kind of memory as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think my approach for sure was more documentary than anything. Like I initially approached it as if I was making a documentary film, which it is. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to start like right off the bat with interviews. So like when I started my sabbatical, I was in Calgary and it was Christmas, so everyone was home. And I had that opportunity to interview, you know, my family members. And my dad's best friend, you know, kind of all within the span of a week. And then it was a month later when I flew to Japan, and then I did all of my interviews in Japan. In terms of the memories, Yeah, the interviews were for sure challenging, and I don't think any of my family members thought it was going to be hard. I had written down a bunch of questions, and I was asking basically all of my siblings like the same questions. At some point, like, I think as a family, you know, we do talk a lot, but we don't really talk about our feelings. And so when I kind of brought up these memories of my dad, I think it was really painful for my family, you know? And I think there was a realization that, you know, there's so much grief that they hadn't really dealt with or really thought about. And so for them, it was an emotional process, but at the same time, like, they've all said to me at some point that it really was important to do that. Like, even for them, just to be a part of the film process and just to see me make this film and even to see it finished, like, for them, as much as it was for me, it was a big, it was a healing process. So yeah, it, like, my family, the response from them has all been like really positive.
So, and then to that end, where did the film start for you and where did it sort of end up? Were you anticipating it to be as immediately emotionally draining as it sounds like it was, or not draining is not the right word, but
that's a pretty good word to describe it.
It seems like, to some extent, it starts with imagery, but also, you've decided to do this. You know it's going to be about your dad. I think you know it's going to be about your dad, or is it even more vague than that when you start?
Well, I think when I started making the film, like, I knew for sure I was going to have to face my own demons. I didn't know to what extent I was going to have to do that. I kept telling people, oh, I'm making a film about my dad. And then, like, a few months later, I would be like, I'm making a film about my dad, but it's actually turning more into a film about me, you know? And so I think for sure I saw that evolution, like, as I was, you know, seeking out stories. Because initially, like, getting those interviews was really about finding more about my father. And then as I was working on the script, I realized, okay, it's actually, like, it has a lot to do with my memories of my father and the real painful ones and you know, including that one in the classroom. And I just thought, okay, this is going to be about our relationship. And so that's it definitely started as me finding more about my dad, knowing that I'd have to incorporate my personal experiences in it, but I just didn't know how much. And then as I was making it, I just realized that it was really about a lot of the regret, I guess, that I was carrying and the guilt that I was carrying was definitely put into the film.
I'm curious about this. I really like that you mentioned this story about your friend gave you or noticed something about this address to your father, a conversation to your father. And one of the things that really resonated for me is that, you know, we don't talk to our parents. We don't talk to our elders. We don't talk to our siblings. Sometimes there's linguistic reasons, or linguistic barriers for that. But I think it's also, you know, cultural factors too. I'm so curious, like, why don't we talk to our family? Like, the you know, because, you know, so much of the emotional weight in this is that you didn't get the chance to express that. And we experience that in the film too, because it's framed as this conversation and we find out that you didn't have this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of it for my father was that it was cultural. You know, I think talking about his past was not necessarily something that he was proud of. Don't think he thought that I would benefit at all from hearing his story. I think he, but and I also do think that, you know, in Japanese culture, like there is an expression, it's shikata ga nai, and essentially it means there's no reason, you know, there's no point, you know. So it's like, what is the point of discussing it if nothing can be done? So I think that kind of cultural understanding like really inhibited him from talking about things that were painful. And I think things that are painful are difficult to talk about in my family, you know, because there's shame that's attached with pain, you know. So it's like you don't want to share those stories because it's embarrassing, but it also because, you know, it carries shame. So I think that's one of the reasons. I feel like, you know, after making this film, like I, again, I'm really close with my family and especially my siblings, and we do talk like we've had more open conversations about painful things since, you know, me making this film, for sure.
Well, that's awesome to hear, like, that film can do that, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you make a film and you're like, what am I doing, right? Yeah. But you know, I think another thing that I feel like this film gets to and that further complicates that, like, that kind of communication is the kind of generational issues between first and second gen, right? That sure. As second gen, you know how hard the first gen has it. You know what they struggled through, and that, like, any of your struggles, like, don't mean anything compared to that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And and I felt that really strongly in your film, and that like, I mean, I think that's also one reason why we don't talk about things sometimes too, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And there's definitely, I think, moments even where my parents kind of reminded me of that, you know? Like, complaining in general was just, like, very much looked down upon in my family. And so it was all about, like, kind of enduring pain. And my family was just like, parents, I should say, my parents didn't want to necessarily hear about my problems.
There's a line at, I think it's at the 4:30 mark, where it's a line that you scripted, that your father wrote. I called out your name because I wanted you to know that I see you. Yeah, this line really, like, okay, honestly, like, I've seen this film like 4 or 5 times. I don't think there's been one time that I've not cried watching your film. I did cry earlier. I was like, oh, gotta cry quietly. But I think about this, I was just kind of curious, like, how many drafts did you have to go through before arriving to what is in this film here?
Many drafts. I think I wrote every line probably about, like, I don't know, like, at least 5 times. And there are some lines in there that I wrote probably 20 times. Like, I just couldn't figure out the best way to say it. But yeah, that line really just came out of just wanting to understand my dad's behaviors. You know, like, just wanting to understand, like, why he teased me at school, like, why he insisted on drawing attention to me in front of my friends, you know, like, I really just wanted so badly to understand that, instead of trying to empathize with me and being like, oh, she's shy, you know, I don't want to embarrass her, I'm going to leave her alone. Like, that was not my dad's thinking.
One thing that I feel is, like, really strong in both films, and we've kind of talked about it too, the effect of growing up in the West, in the prairies, has on your perspective and how you see the world. Obviously, in your film, and, you know, it's your personal experience growing up in Calgary. But there's something about both the location of the prairies, but also in that time, both, you know, I think you're talking about the late 80s. And then Howie, you're talking about the future, but the future kind of in reference to your past, your personal experience there. There's something, like, really interesting about how these places and this time has influenced both of these films. And so first in Anne's, you know, you talk about having, you wanted your dad to be this Japanese salaryman, which, you know, and then you also mentioned Die Hard, right? You wanted him to be the guy who owned the tower in Die Hard, right? Which is James Shigeta, right? Who's awesome. And, you know, it's incredible how that time of the 80s, there's so much like cultural imagination of what Japan was or represented to North America, you know, that it could affect you in that way, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. The media had a huge impact in terms of how I perceived my family and how I perceived myself. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's so fascinating too. And then we see in Howie's film, I mean, I think about similar in that era, in that 80s, and even it carries forward to now, and that like East Asian things being kind of like always the future. And you kind of see that in Howie in your film, that it's like, it's a ramen shop, right? Like that's cosmopolitanism. That's the future. I don't know what I'm kind of getting at, but there's this cultural imagination that that is mixing all this like prairie 80s things together, you know, in both of these films.
Yeah, well, I think like being from the prairies, like I guess I instantly think landscapes, you know, like I think of epic landscapes. I think about the prairies, I think about the mountains, I think about like the desert and the hoodoos, like. And I feel like that's kind of imprinted into my visual brain. And it's like very hard not to include those in my films. And in the same way that you talk about the 80s and those cultural references, like those had such a strong impact, I'm sure, on a lot of visual artists. And, you know, it's hard not to think about those things when you're making and creating something. Like they are inherently influencing our work. So, I totally hear what you're saying, Aram.
I think, I'm not asking the question on behalf of Aram, but like Aram and I talk about this all the time. It's like really interesting to think about how Torontonians kind of think like we are like the be all end all in some way. And so both of your works, both of you as creators from the prairies, where we don't often see as much like narratives or stories from, or at least maybe it's not like it's not in our purview as much. Like it's really interesting to see those stories situated in those spaces specifically.
And also definitely very much informed by those spaces, but also not just the location, but also the time, like the era that you grew up in. Like, I mean, Anne, you're very much, you know, referencing that time in a specific way because that's when you grew up, but also Howie in your piece that you know you are referencing that even though your film takes place mm-hmm. in the future. So, you know, what were some of the things for both of you that made you decide to set these films in the prairies?
Yeah, well, I guess the reason I like my story is set in the prairies because I was born and raised in Calgary, Alberta, but speaking about kind of the influence of the prairies on my films, like I've always been a visual person. And, you know, when I think about the prairies, I think about, you know, epic landscapes. I think about the Rocky Mountains. I think about the prairies. And I think about, like, even the hoodoos near Drumheller. And I feel like, you know, these images are really imprinted into my brain and into my visual brain. So it's hard not to include them in my films because they've been so highly, like, because I've been exposed to them for so long. But also there's I would say that there's a bit of minimalism in my aesthetic, and it's, you know, spaces are open, you know, spaces are not always crowded and cramped. And I would say that growing up in the prairies has really had an impact on my visual design. Like I like generally things to be more minimal and open, and there's space to breathe in it. And that's because I've been surrounded by that kind of landscape where it does always feel so open, and there is always kind of space for me to move around. So
yeah, I was gonna say, Ed, the opening and final shot of your film that is really magical because it, on the one hand, it's very theatrical and sort of we're very aware that this is a set piece and with set lighting and all that. But there's this incredible sense of immersion that you've created in it that I think, I assume, sort of comes from that instinct and that I don't think you would necessarily learn from composition classes. I have no idea how you learn to make art. I don't know if there's such thing as a composition class. I agree with what Anne said, and I'm similar. I think to this day, when I'm asked to do a layout, I start with drawing a straight line, and then clouds usually end up in there somewhere. So I think the other part of it is, and Anne's film speaks very directly to this, very beautifully, is that certainly when we were growing up, and to some extent still now, I think there is a sense of being Asian or in Saskatoon, you know, they still use the term Oriental pretty freely, and that's partly why I very deliberately use the term Oriental as the restaurant in the restaurant name. There is still a sense of sort of exoticism, if not entirely an other, but there's certainly there's an exotic sort of thing where you are fielding questions about what it's like. What do people in your culture do on this day or in this situation? You know, there's a lot of those questions that you have to answer on a daily basis. And growing up, there's a lot of those questions that you answer. When I was growing up, and maybe now still, but I think that sense of difference between sort of whatever the perception of mainstream culture is and whatever we are meant to be, how we fit into that is populates are both our films, I suspect. Did I just say like random words there?
No, you didn't.
I mean, we're all saying random words, right?
I'm just reading things off of Google Translate.
I mean, I think that, this idea of the cultural imagination, we really see this in both films too, especially when we think about that late 80s time, you know, like Anne, in another interview, you had talked about how you wanted your dad to be the salaryman and you wanted him to be the guy who from Die Hard who owned the tower, you know, and then Howie in your film, how, you know, and especially when you think about 80s movies like Blade Runner and stuff like that, it's like how the Asian was like, especially East Asian was like the future, quote unquote, right? And so really see this cultural imagination so strongly in both of these. And cultural imagination specifically, I feel like from that era too.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was in Taiwan a few years ago with my family. The first time I brought my kids there. And there's a few sort of scenes that at night when you're walking through the streets where you think, oh, this is Blade Runner, and I did sort of scratch my head about, you know, was Blade Runner sort of prophetic or is it the other way around, or is it difference, you know? So I do wonder about, because as it turns out, Asia, at least, you know, economically is what everybody seems to be talking about these days. And, you know, certainly in film, China is funding everything, it looks like. So I wonder about sort of whether those films and that moment when we were growing up was precursor or if it's just coincidence that everybody has turned this corner to think to once again see, you know, Asia as the future.
Mm-hmm. Like going back to what Aram was asking, like in regards to those representations of Asia and in my case, like Asian men, like there weren't a ton of Asian men being represented in mainstream Western media, like when I was growing up, but the few representations there were was again, like either Mr. Miyagi as like the Zen master sensei, or like the Japanese salaryman. And like, when you think about the 80s, like there was a huge boom in Japan, you know? So like during that boom, like all of you know, you saw that the Japanese, they were the wealthy ones, you know, they're the ones who had money. And it was really hard for me to kind of negotiate that, because I was like, well, if the Japanese are supposed to be rich, like why is my father and his family not rich, you know? So it was like, you know, it's hard when that your reality is conflicting with, you know, everything that you see in the media. But so yeah, it for sure had an impact in terms of like how I saw myself and obviously how I saw my family, and it does seep itself into my present day work.
And would you say too, I mean, I guess I'm assuming that the communities in, you know, Calgary in the 80s and Saskatoon in the 80s probably, Asian communities, probably not very large, right? So this kind of cultural imagination of Asia, Asian people probably took on kind of an outsized role for you, maybe?
I don't know. The Japanese community is small, but there is a Japanese community for sure in Calgary. And my family was a part of it. Like all of my parents' friends were Japanese. But that being said, like, you know, at my school, there were not a ton of Asian kids, you know? It was hard growing up as, you know, like as an Asian kid in the 80s when there weren't a lot of others like you and you didn't see a lot of yourself on the screen.
Backstory Podcast is written and hosted by Aram Collier and Kelly Louie. It's edited and produced by Sungwoo Beck and is presented by Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. Check out our show notes for more information about Howie and Anne's works. Let us know what you think of this episode. Email us at backstory.ra@gmail.com.